and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, book enthusiast, critic, and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Michael Derda. His talk entitled Reading Matters, How Books Can Change Your Life, was recorded inside the Wilda Marston Theater at the Lusac Library in Anchorage on August 28th.
Good afternoon and welcome to Lusac Library. My name is Susan Urich, and on behalf of the Anchorage Library Foundation, I'm here to introduce Michael Derda, whose talk is the kickoff to the 25th anniversary celebration of the opening of this cherished building. We at the Anchorage Library Foundation believe that free public libraries are essential to the health of our community, and we work to promote, fund, and support the long-term vitality of the Anchorage Public Library. As the Anchorage Public Library expands and opens its service to the community, the Library Foundation partners with the private sector, individuals, businesses, and philanthropic organizations to secure funds to support the library in ways above and beyond the municipal budget. Past successes include the new or remodeled libraries in Girdwood, Chugiak Eagle River, Mountain View, and Muldoon, technology upgrades, and in partnership with the Downtown Rotary, our new Teen Underground at Lusac Library. It's been a pleasure for the Library Foundation to work with the UAA Honors College to bring our speaker to Alaska. Michael Derda is an influential book critic for the Washington Post newspaper, and his literary criticism was awarded the Pulitzer Prize. In addition to his work for the Post, Derda regularly contributes essays, profiles, and reviews to a variety of major publications. His books include The Memoir, An Open Book, and four collections of essays, Readings, Bound to Please, Book by Book, and most recently, Classics for Pleasure. This fall, I understand, his new book, focusing on the author of the Sherlock Holmes stories, will be released. I understand the title is On Conan Doyle, or The Whole Art of Storytelling. Michael grew up in Northern Ohio, reading books wherever he could find them. At the library, on the street, in secondhand shops, and a local department store. Michael relates in his memoir, An Open Book, that he read about Alaska in encyclopedias purchased by his mother in an economical way. Perhaps he'll share that story with us today. Michael Derda graduated with high honors from Oberlin College with a degree in English. After graduation, he was awarded a Fulbright scholarship to teach English in France. When he returned to the United States, he attended graduate school at Cornell University, where he earned his master's and doctorate in comparative literature. Scholar and artist Guy Davenport wrote, "Michael Derda's honest and careful perceptions have been crafted for people who read. He has the wonderful ability to make us feel as intelligent as he is." In a similar vein, another Michael, Michael Kinsley, former editor and columnist at Time, and editor at Slate, has said, "Michael Derda is the best read person in America, but he doesn't rub it in." Please welcome Michael Derda.
Thank you, Sue, for that wonderful introduction. She didn't say that she grew up in the same part of Ohio that I did, and so we have share a lot of common memories. Yesterday, some of you may have heard me speak at the university convocation where I had very prepared remarks, but today I thought we would have more of a conversation. I like to talk about books. I will talk about, for a while, about some of my own experiences with books growing up and later in life. But what I really welcome is the chance to converse with you. Usually people have questions about what it's like to be a book reviewer or life at a major newspaper like the Washington Post, or want to ask questions about contemporary publishing or literature or the teaching of English. All these are matters that interest me and in which I'm involved, and I'd be happy to talk about them with you. So I do want to encourage you to think of a couple of questions you might like to ask a little bit later on. I grew up in Lorain, Ohio, which is a classic Ohio Rust Belt working town. My father was a steel worker. My mother was a homemaker and later a cashier at W.T. Grant's department store. And libraries really are central to my life. So it's a great pleasure to be part of this celebration here in Anchorage of the 25th anniversary of the Lusac Library. My father first took me to the library when I was a child, and I can remember checking out Curious George albums and discovering that, you know, books were a lot of fun. I was lucky enough that my mother taught me to read when I was very, very young. She would wash dishes each evening by hand, and afterwards would sit down in the dining room next to the heat register and take me, I was about 4 years old, in her lap, and open these little golden books with fluffy bunnies and rabbits and little ducklings, and she would get all excited about them. She'd say, "Oh, look at the little golden, you know, duckling and the fuzzy bunny," and I, the heat of the heat register, my mother's lap, her rough red fingers from washing dishes, and I was usually ready for bed. All this generated a great sense of pleasure in me. And if there's one thing that reading is all about, it is pleasure. We read for pleasure, we read for excitement. All the other more elevated things come later. And as I would look at the pictures with her, gradually I started to learn to read, so that I was able to read before I started kindergarten. And there was really no stopping me from that point on. But I was not a particularly good student. I was dreamy. My teachers thought I was slow and hard of hearing. My mother would not buy me glasses because she thought they would spoil my supposed good looks as a child. So I couldn't see the blackboard. So I was always getting very poor marks in school. And it was only much later that I started to improve. And I told the story of that yesterday, so I won't repeat it here. But for me, the key element in learning to develop a passion for books was a book club that the elementary school had called the Tab Book Club, where you were allowed to order books from a little newsletter that came once every couple of months. My mother would permit me to only buy four at a time, no matter how much I pleaded and wheedled, you know, please, no, only four. That's what we have, the library. You can go to the library to check out books. Of course, I was already going to the library, but I liked the idea of having my own books. But early in fifth grade, one of the books offered by the Tab Book Club was described this way. What was it that came out of the moors at night to spread horror and violent death? And what else was it? But of course, it was The Hound of the Baskervilles. I knew nothing about Sherlock Holmes. I didn't know anything about this, but this book sounded exciting, and that's what I read for, excitement. So I ordered the book. The book came, and I realized I had to wait for exactly the right moment to read this. You couldn't just read this casually. So weeks go by until finally a Saturday arrived when it was cloudy and gray, rain, you know, typical Anchorage weather. Well, I'm teasing. We have wonderful weather today. But a typical Ohio November day, and my parents announced that they were going to visit relatives that evening, and they were going to take my three sisters with them so I could stay home alone. They would allow me to stay home alone, and here was my moment. So that afternoon, I got on my bike, and I rode to Whalen's drugstore and bought candy bars and Orange Crush and loaded up on goodies and came back to the house. As soon as my parents pulled out the driveway, I got pulled down a blanket from upstairs and turned off all the lights in the house except one next to the reading chair that I was in, pulled the blanket on, at which point it starts, you know, the clouds open, it starts pouring rain down, and I start reading The Hound of the Baskervilles. one of the great moments of my life. And of course, the supreme moment comes at the end of the second chapter, when Dr. Mortimer, who has come to see Sherlock Holmes and Watson, and is explaining about the curse of the Baskerville family, where each Baskerville, every generation is killed mysteriously, supposedly. And the latest, Sir Charles Baskerville has been found dead, and he went to examine the body, and he says to Holmes, Holmes said, "Did you see anything on around the body?" He said, "I saw footprints." And he said, and Holmes said, "What kind? A man's or a woman's?" And he gives the immortal answer, "Mr. Holmes, they were the footprints of a gigantic hound." End of chapter 2. I said, life never gets any better than that. It's been downhill ever since. I mean, there have been other moments of reading excitement, but that was really one of the high spots. But I read a lot as a kid, but I had to read Catch as Catch Can. I would go to the library, but I was not allowed to check out adult books. So they were very stringent in those days, librarians. You had to be in junior high school, seventh grade or more, in order to read adult books. So I would be frustrated by this, but I would search for books hither and yon. I would ride to the Salvation Army in the places called Clarice's Values, and finding books was part of the adventure of reading them. And I really slowly began to build up a library, and little did I know that today I probably have 15,000-20,000 books. But it all began there in Lorraine. But I didn't really know what to read. It had no good, no guidance. And one day, I saw an ad at the back of the Sunday Supplement magazine for something called The Great Books of the Western World. Some of you may remember The Great Books of the Western World, Mortimer J. Adler and all these. They had a little card, and I sent in the card expecting that they would send a flyer listing the great books of the Western world, because all I wanted were the titles, so I could go to the library and check them out. I knew my parents had no money to buy the great books of the Western world, but they weren't sold that way. A salesman knocks on your door a little later after you send in the card, and this guy comes. He's very persuasive. Wonderful set of books, Educate Your Child, and cost $375. No way my mother and father didn't pay this for these books. But then he starts to add details, saying, that each child in a family can enter a contest, the great book sponsors, to win $500, $1,000, or $5,000, so three prizes, by the quality of your essays. And as soon as this guy said contest, I took my parents aside. My mother is a great contest player. There are stories to tell, but I took her aside, and I said, "Dad, Mom, you buy these books for me. I guarantee that I will win at least $500. We'll make $125 on the steal." And my mother looks at me and says, "You guarantee you'll win that money? You'll win?" And I said, "I'll do it. Don't worry. It's done." and then they bought this. They agreed. They bought the books. The books came. I read the selections. You had to answer questions from readings from the great books in order just to write the essays. Got to that. Wrote the essays. And I did win $500. And a set of the great books were donated to our high school library. Well, that's not the end of the story. I have three younger sisters. As the years go by, my eldest sister, she also wins $500. My middle sister wins $500. And three sets of the great books are now reposing unread, no doubt, in the Admiral King High School Library. At which point, the salesman returns to tell my father that we were one of two families in the United States that had won three times in this contest. And my father looks at him and says, "I have a third daughter." And my little sister, Linda, won $1,000. At which point, she went to the library and said, you don't need any more sets of the great books from us. I'm taking that one home. So she has one in her house that she won for them. But to go to the library, my dad would drive us. He was not a reader himself, nor my mother. But we would go and we would stack up with these books. And it was just wonderful as a child. I mean, if you ever have doubts about the value of a library for your community, just go to the children's book area, the children's section, and look at little kids as they see the picture books and they engage with them. There's a physical intimacy of the object book with the child that no ebook, reader, or screen can generate. And the idea that the child feels that, you know, this is mine, I can take this home for a week, and live in it, is a very important experience. And this was important, you know, for me. I would take these cute stacks home and go through them. When I got older, the wisdom of Lorraine City fathers, they put in a neighborhood library in the local shopping center. So I could ride my bicycle over there or walk to the shopping center and check out books. And so I would go there and I would check out the books and I would go home with them, and I would stop under the streetlights and read some a paragraph, and then run to the next one and work my way home. So there was just quite wonderful to have these books around. As you grow older, books, you know, they become. You never know what's going to influence you. I loved mystery stories from the Sherlock Holmes, and I read Father Brown as a kid. When I was in seventh grade, somebody told me that Crime and Punishment was a murder mystery. And I said, okay. And I found an old Bantam paperback of it, and I started reading it as a murder mystery, of course. And it was great. I loved it. I read it in 3 days, couldn't put it down. It was the first really serious grown-up book I'd ever read, and after that, there was no stopping me. I read grown-up books all from then on. Well, I kept reading, you know, juveniles and the like. There's a wonder, if you've never read it, you should go find The Thurber Carnival by James Thurber. He has a delightful essay called The Macbeth Murder Mystery about a woman who reads Macbeth as if it were a classic English mystery and discovers who really killed King Duncan. It wasn't the Macbeths. When I was in 7th and 8th grade, I had some wonderful teachers. I had in 8th grade, I had a teacher who was taking classes in Cleveland, and he would drive to Cleveland and stop at a big pub, what was it called? I can't remember the name, but a huge paperback bookstore. And he said he could buy us books for the class if we wanted us to pick up things, because Lorraine didn't have much in the way of books. So I remember the first book I asked him to buy for me was Dale Carnegie's How to Stop Worrying and Start Living. I was in eighth grade, and I was already a neurotic, strange kind of character who needed help. The second book I had him buy me was Thoreau's Walden. And I later read Carnegie's other books, How to Win Friends and Influence People, and his books on public speaking and the like. And I realized, looking back on it many, many years later, these were actually perfect books to start off with in their different ways. Because what Carnegie is all about is he teaches you how to get along with people, how to engage with society, how to make yourself winning and presentable, how to talk in terms of the other person's interests. He's outward looking in his attitude toward the world, whereas Thoreau is different. He gives you the exact opposite. He says, the world doesn't matter. What matters is that you become who you are. No matter how the world might think of you, you need to trust your own self, your own instincts. And they were a good balance for me as I went out into high school and later life. I have lots of stories about books. I didn't know that I was going to become a book reviewer or work at a newspaper writing essays about books. Till my late 20s, when I first started to do this, I thought I was going to be a college teacher, and I went off to the nearest college to Lorraine, Oberlin College, 13 miles away, after making my parents promise never to come visit me. And I went through a considerable amount of culture shock, but ultimately I did very well there, and I did go to France, and I taught in the Lycée in Marseille, a wonderful year there, and did go to graduate school in comparative literature. I started off in medieval studies, spent 2 years in medieval studies, then switched to European Romanticism, wrote a dissertation on the French writer Stendhal, and came down to Washington because my then-girlfriend, now long my wife, was working at the Library of Congress, and found a job as a technical writer for a computer company. Well, actually, I applied for some teaching jobs, was offered some in various places. Marion didn't want to go, so I stayed in Washington, became a technical writer for a computer company for a while, but began to write book reviews on the side. The book reviews did pretty well, and after I'd written about a dozen of them, the Post offered me a job, just like that, to be an assistant editor at Bookworld. And I thought about it. I could see, you know, that computers were going nowhere, so that it was a good test. And it was, you know, time to leap, jump ship and go over to something solid and dependable. They would never have any problems with newspapers. And so I did. And I was very happy at Bookworld for 25 years as an editor and as a writer. Did everything, laid out the pages when the art director was away, started our science fiction and fantasy column, and became close friend. My closest friends are science fiction and fantasy writers, and wrote lots of book reviews, lots of essays, until about eight years ago, when the Post first offered a buyout for people in editorial, that is, writers and reporters. I was the youngest person eligible. I'd been there long enough and was old enough. And I took it knowing that they would offer me a contract to be a weekly columnist. And I could give up being an editor since I was working half-time as an editor. I just wanted to write more. And I felt that I could generate enough income through writing pieces for the New York Review of Books and the Times Literary Supplement. And I do a monthly column about older books through the Barnes & Noble Review online. And doing all sorts of literary activities that would, you know, earn me a dime or a dollar, and so I've been doing that ever since. My life has really been involved with books from, you know, the age of four, when my mother first taught me to read, and I'm grateful for that. They continue to fascinate me. I still, when I worked at Bookworld, every day they would have these huge trolleys come in filled with book mailers, and you'd dump them on the floor, and it was like Christmas every day. You never knew it was going to be there. And I still feel that way about books. And whenever I go to a small town, I stop in the library to look around and get the feel of it. I find libraries and used bookstores among the most, they're great refuges. You feel at peace in libraries, when no matter how much the world may be troubling you. If you go into the library, there's something restful here. There's the sense that you have a connection with, you know, the great minds of the past. Just the presence of physical books seems to impart a kind of wisdom. You feel a little more anchored, than you did before. So I think, you know, that they're wonderful places, almost in the way of secular churches, as well as, obviously, their cultural centers for communities. And I just think, you know, that they are central to any kind of community of work. Now, I'm going to stop. I mean, I can talk about book reviewing, or I can talk about all these things I mentioned earlier on in the program. But I think you might have some questions. I hope you do. And we can chat for a while.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Michael Derda, book critic and Pulitzer Prize-winning author. His talk entitled Reading Matters, How Books Can Change Your Life, was recorded at the Lusac Library in Anchorage on August 28th. In the second half of the program, Michael Derda responded to questions from audience members.
The question is, how do I decide which books I'm going to review? For many years, when I worked at Bookworld, I could obviously look at all the books that came through. I assigned most of the books that we reviewed in the humanities, that is fiction, poetry, intellectual history, things like that. I didn't assign books in politics or foreign affairs or those social studies, as you might call it. So I wrote regularly every week. But if I didn't, you know, if I started a book, right, if I didn't like it, I would stop and I would assign it to somebody else, give it another chance. So that most of my reviews, if you look at them, tend to be positive. There are only a few really negative reviews because I would sift them through. I figure if I'm going to read the book, I want to enjoy it. I want it to be something worthwhile. My tastes are eclectic, and I do try to be as broad as possible. So that if I review a long, involved, intricate experimental novel, say 1 week, I will review something lighter the next week. If I've done a lot of fiction, I'll interrupt it with some biographies or intellectual history or poetry, just to get a balance, to keep things interesting to me and to others. But I follow my tastes. You read a page or two and you know from the moment whether the author possesses the wand of the enchanter. If he or she can, you know, grab you with his or her sentences, you want to keep reading. That's what books are all about. You know, if you want to turn the page, you've got a good book. But the things I review, if you look at the books that are out on the table, are very eclectic. I've written about the Bible. I've written about classics and a dozen different foreign languages translated. I've written about contemporary fiction. I remember one Valentine's Day, for example. I reviewed three Harlequin romances for Valentine's Day. And I remember the lead sentence, too, was, "This is where I lose all credibility as a critic, because I like them. I said they were really good." They weren't meretricious. They were witty. They were working within a very narrow genre, but within those constraints, they were really quite good books. And on the other hand, you know, I will review really, you know, quite strange things, and people know that I have odd tastes. So, for example, there's a French school of innovative writing called the Oulipo. Translates as those are acronyms for the Workshop for Potential Literature. And this is a group that believes that constraints liberate the imagination. So that the most famous example of a book by an Oulipo writer is Georges Perec's La Disparition, The Disappearance, although it's translated as A Void. This is the novel, an entire novel written without using the letter E. There's no E's at all in the book. And it's actually a meaningful kind of book because E in French is pronounced er, which means them. And in the novel, each time somebody is forced to say a word that has an E in it, there's no way around it for the author, they die. And the book is... er is them, and it's really a kind of a book about the Holocaust because it's about the disappearance of them, the disappearance of E. Who's in this case Perec's parents, who died in the Holocaust. But there are other novels written like Checkerboard Moves, A Knight Moves on a Chessboard. I like those sorts of things. My intent as a reviewer is not to be one of these sort of draconian critics who says, you know, this will never do, but really. To share some of my affection and enthusiasm for writers and books that I like, and to encourage people to go and read them. Throughout my career, my greatest ambition was to try to break the lock of the bestseller list on people's imaginations. Too many people, I think, follow the books on the bestseller list and neglect the other books that might actually speak to them more directly than any of the often really trashy books on the list, although there are many good books on the list too. But along with that, I've also been a great champion for genre literature, science fiction, fantasy, crime novels, westerns. Years ago, I wrote a piece for The Nation magazine called The Genre Ghetto, in which I premised that in the coming generation of writers, just starting going to come along in the next 20, 30 years, that genre literature would be central to their imaginations. And as if you look now at mainstream writing, what we think of as mainstream, so much of it is filled with fantasy. Crime novels have become our realistic novels. The Western has become a great commentary on American life through Cormac McCarthy or Larry McMurtry and people like this. So you do see that. Literary history has always moved at a kind of oblique angle. It doesn't go father to son or mother to daughter. It goes aunt and uncle to nephew and niece, so that people will revolt against the dominant realistic strand at the end of the 50s and 60s and go off to the sides, to the margins, to the writers who were thought to be unimportant, and they will make them important. So science fiction writers, and Jonathan Lethem, and people like Michael Chabon, they grew up reading comics, and these are central to the way they write now. That's one question. Another question, yes, sir. I remember talking to Mike Dunham, but I haven't actually seen the article yet. Harsh about e-books. Yes, I did. My feeling about e-books is that they're obviously, they've got a lot of momentum behind them. They are clearly going to become more and more important. But I think there are dangers associated with them. The dangers, I think, have to do with the nature of screens and computers. Computers are all based on speed. You look at kids using a computer, they go link, 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 boom, 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 boom. Everything is fast, and they're wonderful for information retrieval. They will give you the facts whenever you want them. But they also encourage, I think, a slightly superficial way of reading as a result, because everything is so ephemeral seeming. It's just a screen. It'll disappear. You move on to the next one. Whereas a book, a physical book, encourages that kind of slow interaction, that active attention that I think really serious reading requires. That it's certainly possible to read that way on a screen, and perhaps the next generation will be able to read that way. But my fear is that the thrust of the screen experience is to be quick, shallow, and fat, and just skim the surface of things, looking or to a way that many young people read. They don't read the whole article. They just go look for the answer to the question they have in mind, or for the point, so that all the context of an argument, all the context is of some sort of a field of of experience or knowledge is lost. That's the fear that I have with screens. That said, I spoke earlier when I was about little kids and physical books. I think physical books are really important in that they all look different. Now, if you read, you're reading, Philip Marlowe, Raymond Chandler crime novels, you want them to be almost in a, 25-cent paperback with a leggy blonde on the cover and a guy in a trench coat. I mean, that's how they feel right. If you're reading Henry James, you have a stately, hardcover edition, maybe a reprint of the New York edition of James's works. And that feels right for him. Whereas on the screen, everything kind of looks the same. And this sort of homogenization, I think, takes away a dimension of the reading experience that the physical book has. The other thing I like is that with real books, physical books, you can build up a personal library, and you have it there around you. Yes, you can have the books in your e-reader, but they're not part of your living space in the way that the books you have on your shelves. And just seeing them every day, you might pull one out and read a paragraph, or you remember something and you'll check it against the book. And they will remind you, you haven't read me. You should, here's something, they're there. They become part of your life Plus, a personal library is a reflection of who you are. I mean, books in an e-reader are kind of like a library, a big library. I mean, here we have every book you could possibly want, say, in this library. But they're just the whole wealth of books. Whereas the books that you own yourself, that you have at home, that you buy, those are your books. They are part of you. You have made the selections because they represent something inside you, either or the kind of person you want to be, or something. That narrowing, that selection effect is important, I think, rather than simply having everything available. I mean, how often, remember when Xeroxing came in? Everyone would Xerox everything, and then you'd put it in a file and never actually read it, you know, because you had it, you knew you had it, you didn't have to. Well, the same thing, it's in some ways, that thinking you have it, everything here in just your little computer, people forget about learning things themselves, carrying them around in their memory. I mean, when I was a kid, I used to walk to high school, and I had this long walk, and I would memorize poems, you know, just to amuse myself. And they always stood me in good stead. I have stories about the poems. I probably shouldn't stop. But another question. The question is whether the internet has changed my ability to concentrate on books. I would say the internet hasn't, but that maybe age has to some degree. You get older and you start falling asleep if it's after 8 o'clock at night and you're reading, unless it's really exciting. I'm not heavily involved with technology beyond writing on a machine, that kind of glorified typewriter, and also using it for email. But no, I don't think it's changed for me. Other questions? Way in the back, sir.
The
question is, what makes a novel good? What makes it meaningful, alive, as a book? For me, a lot comes down to style. I really do respond to the way a writer writes. That tone, Elmore Leonard used to call it the sound on the page. If the sound is right, then you're willing to read and follow that author anywhere, because the voice carries you along. We're all children in some ways, responding to our mothers telling us stories. And I think that the great authors are able to persuade us to listen to their stories. Beyond that, every kind of book has a different set of aesthetic standards. You're not going to read a light romance or mystery story in the same way that you would read Proust or James Joyce. Each book offers a different kind of pleasure. I do think that pleasure is important. In my own experience, we grow up with school these days emphasizing aspects of character change in novels. You know, the characters are three-dimensional, and they deepen, they have crises, they come through. I'm a great believer and advocate of one of the neglected aspects of fiction, which is plot. I think plot is really important. People who can organize the structure of a story so that things unfold at the proper way and keep your interest. And one reason I wrote this book that's coming out in the fall on Conan Doyle was to talk about plot. It's subtitled The Whole Art of Storytelling. That's actually a reference to Sherlock Holmes. Some of you may remember that Sherlock Holmes, when he's going to retire, he's going to go back to working on his masterpiece, his masterwork, which is The Whole Art of Detection. But Conan Doyle wrote all kinds of stories. He was a master at plotting. And I found that, I may someday write a big book about the period from 1880 to about 1930, which I think of as the great age of storytelling, a time when you had mass literacy, you had the rise of magazines, people could read. It was before the competition of the serious competition of radio and television and movies. And popular fiction flourished as never before. And here's where a lot of our great myths started from people like Sherlock Holmes to the great adventure novels, King Solomon's Mines, or She, or figures of mythic dimensions like Peter Pan, Prisoner of Zenda, Captain Blood, Lost World. All these things are coming out in the same lifetime, one person's lifetime. And I think that's remarkable and interesting. So plot is important to me. I like good stories. I do read for pleasure. I think everything else comes afterwards. Other questions, please? Yes, ma'am. How books have changed a person's life? Well, I mean, everybody will have different books that change their lives. I mean, has a book changed your life? A lot of books have? Well, that's probably the answer for most people, but that books do change lives is the point. That a lot of people, if we look back on our lives, we can see a moment when you know, there was this book led us in a new direction. For example, I'll give you a very practical example. When I was in 10th or 11th grade, I read Nikos Kazantzakis' novel, Zorba the Greek. Most of you probably know the movie. You remember the movie with Anthony Quinn, Zorba the Greek? Zorba is this sort of old Greek guy with full of life and vitality, a sort of pagan god. And there's this young Englishman who's very repressed and like. Anyway, you know this, and he becomes sort of Zorba's disciple. Well, I'm reading this book. I found a paperback of it. And I came to a passage early on in the novel where the young Englishman writes, "I had fallen so low that if I'd had to choose between falling in love with a woman and reading a book about love, I would have chosen the book." And I said, "God, that's me, you know." And I went out on my first date the following week. So there's an example of a book that changed a life. Who knows? I could be, you know. An old bachelor at this point if I'd never run across the novel. Other questions? Yes, sir.
Well, whether or not they really wrote the book?
Well, most of the kinds of books I review tend to be clearly written by their authors. But the pop books, the celebrity books, the political memoirs, the books of that sort that go on the bestseller list, almost all of them are actually written by someone other than their author, or at least in close association with their author. And I have friends who are ghostwriters, who have worked on quite famous books with writers, and some are known, and some we prefer not to be known. And that is, you know, it's common enough. It's one reason why these books are so ephemeral. Who today would read R.N., The Memoirs of Richard Nixon? No one, you know, except some Nixon scholars, ever going to read that book again. You know, here in Washington at the Post, we used to make fun of every you know, there would be the election book. Every presidential candidate would come out with some book about his vision of America. It would be cranked out by his staff, and he would do, you know, and would sign it, and it would be utterly forgotten, you know, 6 months later. I mean, and this is just the way of the world. But when somebody is fashionable or in the news, publishers see an opportunity to make some money. Because publishing, after all, is a business. But this doesn't make the books a result of anything except temporary interest for most of us. So yes, you're right to feel suspicious. I've written a memoir, so I know, you know, I'm always suspicious of memoirs that quote a lot of actual conversation and dialogue from the person's past when they were, you know, like 9 years old. I mean, I have a terrific memory. I do. I just do. And even I cannot, you know, recall, you know, dinner conversations from that era. I can remember snatches of phrases and things. So that you would come across various people who would write about their past, and you'd have 3 or 4 pages of extensive conversation. It's got to be all made up. And anyone who writes memoir, which is usually the central problem for these sorts of issues, you have this tension always at work between truth and design. In order to have a book that's readable, in order to have a work of art of any kind, you have to impose an order, a design. You have, you know, because life itself is chaotic, it's disorganized, there's no system to it. And if you just transcribed everything that happened to you, it would be unreadable. It would be, you know, the kind of thing people used to say Joyce was. Well, he isn't. So you have to select. When I wrote my memoir, An Open Book, I didn't just talk about everything that happened to me as a kid. The idea was it was to be about how reading changed my life. So books and reading are the thread that runs through the whole thing. But beyond that, I talk about my experiences book. I wanted to have a certain kind of design. So the book takes me from roughly the age of 4 to the age of 19. It opens with me, with the story I told you at the beginning, of me sitting in my mother's lap, learning to read, in the dining room of my house. So it's very warm and closed. It's got just this very specific place. And as the chapters go out, my world, as my reading knowledge grows, expands. So the next chapter is about my family a bit more, and then my neighborhood, and then the town, and then the schools, and larger things. And so that the final chapter is when I go to France, and I'm in Europe, finally getting out of the United States. So the effect is that it's growing as my own knowledge of myself through books is growing. That's fairly subtle. It's, you wouldn't necessarily pick up on it. I don't want you to, but it's there as a kind of ground current. At the same time, I decided that you wanted to have different, you have to have a rhythm to the book, so that if one chapter seemed to me particularly sentimental or nostalgic or wistful or something like that, I would make an effort to try to arrange the next chapter so there'd be lots of funny stuff in it. Or if one chapter might be very discursive, it'd be remembering things in a kind of essayistic way, well, the next section would be much more dramatic, or I would have interaction with people and different things, so that the book maintains a kind of constant vitality by changing. You don't just sort of sit down into one mode throughout it. So you have different kinds of little unseen skeleton behind the way the book is organized. You don't necessarily notice that when you're reading it, but I hope that the effect is that it gives a kind of pleasure that you know you're in the hands of somebody who is taking you through his experiences with books in life, and in doing so in a way that's amusing and entertaining. Let's see, we haven't looked over this way. Yes, sir, over there, ma'am. Yes. Okay. The question is, because I have friends who are writers, whether it's science fiction or other genres, whether I have to excuse myself from reviewing their books, or whether, if I've met writers, whether my finding them irritating would affect my reviewing. The general answer is that for most of my career at Bookworld, I took great pains not to get to know writers very well. In some cases, not at all, because if I knew them well or if they became friends, I could not review their books. The Post had very strong standards of that sort. In fact, as an editor, I would often call up people to review and say, would you review this book? But I would always ask, is there any connection with the author that we should know about that would, make problems for us? And you don't want somebody's brother-in-law reviewing the book. Once I forgot to ask this question, and later was discovered that it was a work of history, and I asked another distinguished historian to review it. And I later discovered that the reviewer, a woman historian, had been the lover of the author of this book when they were both graduate students together. This is not the sort of thing we want to encourage in our reviews. At least here in this country. They're different in England and Europe. They would say, that's great, more of that. But in my case, I would review books, and then often afterwards I would get to know the writer, particularly if they liked the review and they would write to me. I remember I reviewed Possession by Antonia Byatt, and she came to Washington shortly afterwards. We had lunch, we hit it off, we became pen pals. And so I can never review A.S. Byatt's books again. And that was a problem for me. So I would there are certain writers I've reviewed a lot, and I've made pains not to get to know them so I could continue to review their books. It's a kind of a strange paradox. In the case of science fiction writers, Neil Gaiman is a very good friend of mine. I reviewed American Gods, one of his better-known books, And I've not been able to review him again since, because he is a friend of mine. So it is an issue. Other questions? Yes. Oh. Well, I mean, for the Post, when we review books, we're reviewing current books. A book that's more than 2 or 3 months old is too old for us to review the Post. So it's just as you go to bookstores now, the current books are only on the shelves for a few months, and then they push them aside, except for certain perennials. I do like to review classics. I review lots of classics. Most of the books of Bound to Please has a lot of older books. And for the Barnes & Noble Review, I review, I have a feature called Library Without Walls, where I do write about books from around the world and older books, more often than not. My own tastes tend to be toward classics. As we get older, our tastes do change. When we're young, we love fiction and poetry, and when we're older, we love nonfiction. Why is that? Fiction and poetry are all about love. I mean, and that's what interests us when we're young. And as we get older, it's not that we're necessarily less interested, but usually we've settled down or married or, you know, solved a lot of the issues that troubled us when we were young. And so we're more interested in trying to understand ourselves as human beings in the world. And that's why we turn to history and philosophy and other kinds of non-biography, nonfiction, because the questions are different. I mean, that's a generalization. Obviously, we read both kinds of books throughout our lives. But, yes. Yes?
So, a lot of new writers learn to share an interesting story about being stalked.
About being stalked? So far as I know, I've never been stalked, but maybe I had very good stalkers. I mean, I have friends who were writers and have written many books who actually have given up publishing because they feel that the whole industry has become so vulgar and crude through social networking, the self-promotion, that they don't want to have any part of it. It is certainly an issue for writers of a certain age. If you're a middle-aged guy, you know, bald and fat, and you've been writing good novels for 20 years, but they've just been, you know, good novels that people like. You have a hard time right now getting your books published. Publishers want really two kinds of books. They want blockbusters that'll make them tons of money. So those are either going to be written by trade names, brand names, so that, you know, they know they'll make their money back on Stephen King or James Patterson. Or they want to get young, hot, new writers who might be establishing the trends, who will connect with the young people in college and will become, you know, fashionable writers. So they want 23-year-olds who are knockouts of whatever sex, that they have jackets on and smile and go on talk shows and radio, and that people will, might catch fire. So that if you're not in either of those categories, publishing has become much more difficult. I think maybe one or two more questions, then we should probably adjourn for books and refreshments. Purple Brows. Question is, do I review authors again and again and again? I do review authors more than once, but I usually do not review, if I review this book, I don't review 6 books by them in a row. Take someone like, this next Thursday, in Book World, I'm reviewing Stephen Milhauser's selected stories. It's called We Others. I've read Stephen Milhauser's books and reviewed him maybe 4 times in the past. He's written a lot of books. He's one of my favorite writers. So if you've never read him, he's just a wonderful kind of literary fantasy writer, a beautiful stylist. But I would review maybe 1 out of every 3 or 4 of the books he does and give other people a chance to comment on him. And that's true of certain writers that I like. I'm fond of, over the years, I reviewed a lot of books by or about Nabokov, Evelyn Waugh, Milhauser, Russell Hoban, Daniel Pinkwater, all sorts, different writers, various poets, Anthony Hecht. These are people that speak to me in some sort of a magical way. So I like to go back to their books. We all have certain writers like that who just, there's a connection there that's even beyond the ordinary one of them. We like the book. Okay, in there? Yes. You're on. It's an interesting question. Do I think of myself as a reader or a writer? I, for a long time, I thought of myself primarily as a reader. And I was someone who liked to read books and was involved. Writing about them was one aspect of it, but working in a book review section, interviewing writers sometimes, it was all part and parcel. As I've gotten older, I've become more and more interested in my own writing. I don't know whether it's the idea of mortality looming, that I want to try and get as much of my own self on paper as I can, even if it's through the means of writing about other people's books. I mean, if you have eyes to see, and you wouldn't necessarily have them, a lot of my reviews and essays are autobiographical, even if they're not obviously so, or they have some particular meaning to me at various points of my life. And
all right.
Okay, Sue wants me to tell you about. She mentions that my discovery of Alaska as a child was a result of the marketing of encyclopedias when I was young. It was common then for supermarkets and other places to offer volume one of an encyclopedia for some nominal amount of money, 29 cents, 69 cents, and you would buy that one or sign up for that one. And then the subsequent 25 volumes would all be, you know, $10 or $20 each, or whatever the price was. So it was my mother's practice to buy for these, you know, small sums, the first volume of every encyclopedia that came along. So when we went off to school, my three sisters and I, in elementary school, my mother would always say, remember, when they want you to do reports on subjects, you can do it on anything you want so long as it starts with the letter A. So we all wrote our papers on, you know, aluminum and Alaska and, you know, things like that. Well, I could talk a lot more, and I think we could, but we should have some refreshments. Come up and ask me questions privately. You know, please, you know, take a look at my books. I'd be happy to sign any number of them. They make wonderful presents. And thank you all for coming out this afternoon.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Michael Derda, book critic and Pulitzer Prize-winning author. Michael responded to questions from audience members following his talk entitled Reading Matters, How Books Can Change Your Life. In celebration of the Lusac Library's 25th anniversary, the Anchorage Library Foundation, in partnership with the UAA Honors College, hosted Michael Derda at the Lusac Library in Anchorage on August 28, 2011. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our new website, alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.